Lord Sheringham would undoubtedly have met with the same reception had he not presumed in a very unhandsome way upon his long acquaintance with the family, by riding over from Sheringham Place, where he had been spending the night, leaving his horse at the stables, and walking up through the gardens to enter the house through one of the long windows that opened onto the lawn. Encountering an astonished footman, his lordship, very much at home, had tossed his whip and his gloves onto a table, laid his curly-brimmed beaver beside them, and demanded the master of the house. Mr. Milbourne, being quite unblessed by the worldly wisdom which characterized his spouse, had no sooner grasped the purpose of this visit than he suggested vaguely, and not very hopefully, that his lordship had better speak to Isabella himself.
"For I'm sure I don't know, Anthony," he had said, looking doubtfully at the Viscount. "There is no saying what may be in their heads, no saying at all."
Correctly divining this cryptic utterance to refer to his wife and daughter, his lordship had said,
"At all events, you've no objection, sir, have you?"
"No," replied Mr. Milbourne. "That is, no, I suppose I don't object. But you'd best see Isabella for yourself."
So the Viscount was ushered into the beauty's presence, before she had time even to draw down the blind against the too searching light of day, and had plunged, without the slightest preamble, into the first offer of marriage he had ever made. Miss Milbourne found herself in the unhappy predicament of not knowing her own mind. The Viscount had been one of her acknowledged suitors for the past year, and the fact of her having known him almost from the cradle did not blind her to his charms. He was a handsome young blade, wild enough to intrigue the female fancy, and if not as brilliant a match as the Duke of Severn, who had lately shown flattering symptoms of being on the verge of declaring himself, at least he was much more presentable, his grace being a stolid young man inclined to corpulency. On the other hand, the Viscount was by no means so devout a lover as his friend Lord Rotham, who had several times offered to blow his brains out, if such a violent act would afford her pleasure. In fact, the suspicion had more than once crossed Miss Milbourne's mind that the Viscount had joined the throng of her admirers for no better reason than that he was never one to be out of the mode. His professed adoration had not so far led him to abandon the pursuit of opera dancers and Cyprians, or to rectify those faults of character to which Miss Milbourne had more than once taken exception. She was a little piqued by him. If he would but display a few tangible signs of his devotion, such as reforming his way of life, which was shocking, growing slightly haggard like poor Rotham, turning pale at a snub, or being cast into rapture by a smile, she thought she would have been much inclined to accept his proffered suit. But instead of behaving in a fashion which she had come to regard as her due, the Viscount continued on his reprehensible course, according her certainly a good deal of homage, but apparently deriving just as much pleasure as ever from a set of sports and pastimes which seemed to have been chosen by him with a view to causing his family the maximum amount of pain and anxiety. She stole a look at him under her eyelashes. No, he was not as handsome as poor Rotham, whose dark, stormy beauty troubled her dreams a little. Rotham was a romantic figure, particularly when his black locks were dishevelled through his clutching them in despair. The Viscount's fair curls were dishevelled too, but there was nothing romantic about this, since the disorder was the result of careful combing. And Miss Milbourne had a strong suspicion that his passion for herself was not of such a violent nature as to induce him to interfere with his valet's inspired handiwork. He was taller than Rotham, rather loose-limbed, and inclined to be careless of his appearance. Not that this criticism could be levelled at him on this occasion, Miss Milbourne was obliged to own. He had dressed himself with obvious care. Nothing could have been neater than the cravat he wore, nothing more rigorously starched than the high points of his shirt collar. The long-tailed coat of blue cloth, made for him by no less a personage than the great Stultz, set without a crease across his shoulders. His breeches were of the fashionable pale yellow, and his top boots were exquisite.